Okay, so to review, we're going to talk about dysproteinemias. And to talk about dysproteinemias, you've already kind of mentioned them. But you need to look at the structure of an immunoglobulin. And you know that they're named for their heavy chains. So when we talk about this in hematology, we're talking mainly about IgGs, IgAs, and IgMs. Possibly IgD myelomas. Okay, but you have to know that the heavy chains, what we name them after, and the light chains, of course, are either kappa or lambda. And when you get what we call a paraprotein, what that means is that we have overproduction of one kind of immunoglobulin. It all comes from one clone of cells. So the clone of cells is going to be repeated, repeated, repeated. It looks very redundant. And so there can be a dysgratia then in the B lymphocyte or the plasma cell that's putting out this abnormal immunoglobulin. And so what you're going to have is an imbalance of the light chain, whether it be kappa or lambda, and the heavy chains. And so these light chains seem to want to form dimers, two of them together, or they have fragments that pass through the urine because they're small. So they'll go through the kidneys and come out in the urine. And when we find that protein, those light chains in the urine, it's called a Bence-Jones protein. And that's one of the things that we test for. We also do on these people electrophoresis, a protein electrophoresis. And what we see on electrophoresis pattern then is what we call an M spike, okay, or an M band, which stands for myeloma. Or monoclonal gammopathy. So when we're doing the electrophoresis on these people, what we're going to see is the albumin on this, which is the fastest, so it's coming this way. And then we find a spike in the region either of the gamma or the beta area, or in between. And that indicates to us then that there's this clone of cells that are producing too much of this immunoglobulin, there's an imbalance. So this M spike, 80% of them that we see will migrate in the gamma region and about 6 in the beta to gamma region and about 13 in the beta. There might be a small incidence of alpha region, 1%. Now these people that have multiple myelomas or paraproteins or M spikes, it's not very common, but it's more common in older people. And so the incidence is about 3% if they're over 70, but only about 1% if they're under 70. So we usually associate this with an older age group. So don't tell me that a child 5 years old has multiple myeloma. Yeah?
1% of the population?
Mm-hmm.
Under 70, yes.
But usually they're 60 to 50 to 70. It's older age group. So what would we see that we'd even look for an M spike? Why would we do an electrophoresis to see this? Well, when you go into the hospital or you go to a routine physical, some of the things they'll order would be what they call a metabolic panel. And the metabolic panel has on it a total protein. If the total protein is increased, they would look to see why, and they would do an electrophoresis. Or if they happen to have a low anion gap, in other words, the sodium potassium doesn't equal the bicarb chloride, so there's an anion gap there. Or if they have high calciums, or if they're anemic, or if they have an increased sed rate. So you remember that if you have RULO, that formation, that it increases the sed rate. So if they have any of these, they've gone into the physician, if they have any of those, then they'd probably follow up to see if they have an M spike. So they would do then a protein electrophoresis. Probably the most common thing we would see would be RULO. And if you know and you make another slide and it's still there, and you see RULO, then it indicates usually that we ought to follow up with protein testing. At the same time, they may also do a urine test to concentrate the protein in the urine and then do an electrophoresis on the urine, and they're going to find what we call Bence Jones protein. So it's the free light chains that we see. So if we see this, we follow up, we do serum protein electrophoresis. If we see an M spike, we have to figure out which immunoglobulin it is. Is it G, M, A, D? Okay? So we do immunoelectrophoresis to figure out which protein it might be. And then we also get a 24-hour urine sample, concentrate the protein, and look for Bence Jones protein. So those are the things we do to confirm an M spike. So if they have an M spike, there's a couple of diseases that we can say they have. One is multiple myeloma. So multiple myeloma usually is an IgG, an IgA, an IgD, very rarely IgE, or it can even be just light chains. But what you see in these patients is that they have anemia, but it's normal chromic normocytic. They have normal white count. They have normal platelet count usually. We're not going to see plasma cells out in the peripheral blood. You might see it if you did a buffy coat, but they're not real prominent in the peripheral blood. And then the biggest thing we're going to see is Rouleau. So then they do a bone marrow. Okay, in the bone marrow, they're going to find what we call myeloma cells. So these myeloma cells might have inclusions, or they may look pretty like this, but we call a what? Flaming plasma cell. Mm-hmm. Or this may be what we see on the peripheral blood. So the only thing really there that you see is Rouleau. And how many have to be stacked for it to be Rouleau?
Four.
Okay, good. See, you're all ready. So that's just a normal lymphocyte, but you see Rouleau. Okay, they did a bone marrow then. So you look at the bone marrow, and what you see are sheets of plasma cells. So they're going to all come from one clone, so they look pretty much the same. They all look like they came from the same family. They may not be the same age, but this is all the children that came from this cell. Okay, now you notice that some are dividing, so they don't look exactly like each other. But if you notice, they all have the same characteristic. They're kind of vacuolated. These are in transition. But what's this right here? A what? Yeah, an inclusion. What's its name? Russell body. What's a Russell body? Immunoglobulins. Okay. So this is the scheme that we're going to use. We do a CBC, we do a peripheral smear. Probably they're going to have anemia. But on the peripheral smear, what we note in the laboratory that gives them a clue is Rouleau. So now they do a bone marrow. They're going to immunophenotype that bone marrow cell, but if they have greater than 30% myeloma cells, we're going to say they have plasma cell myeloma or multiple myeloma.
Would they really do both the bone marrow and the electrophoresis? Couldn't they just do electrophoresis?
They'll still do the bone marrow. Unless you have a tattoo that says no bone marrow.
In plasma cell leukemia, do they also get Rouleau?
Uh-huh. Because it's just meaning that the myeloma is spilled out into the blood, right? Yeah, they will. So you do the electrophoresis, you see the M spike, and then you have to send or do the immunoelectrophoresis and see what kind it is. Okay? So if a person has multiple myeloma, what's going to be the problem? Well, these myelomas have Bence Jones protein. So these dimers are going through their kidney. So anytime you have protein going through the kidney, it's going to plug up the kidney and cause kidney failure. So many of them have what's called a myeloma kidney. I'll show you a picture of that. They may also have cryoglobulins, which means these are these abnormal proteins that if they get cold at all, they'll start to precipitate out. They also have susceptibility to infection. Many of them die because of infection because they can't make normal immunoglobulins. They're so busy making abnormal immunoglobulins. Amyloidosis is a condition where they start to lay down this proteinaceous material in all the organs. So they can do it in the kidney, they can do it in the liver, the spleen, anywhere, heart. And so many of them have amyloidosis. They have bone pain, and they have punched-out lesions. Punched-out lesions, I'll show you a picture of. Here's a myeloma kidney. So many of them have this deposition of these abnormal proteins in their kidney, which causes kidney failure. This is showing you an infection because they can't make normal immunoglobulins. So they are very prone to infections. This is showing you a picture of the punched out lesions. So anywhere this myeloma takes over, they show no bone formation. So these are called myeloma lesions, showing punched out lesions. They're osteolytic, meaning they dissolve the bone. And this is a picture showing you the section of a lumbar spine that shows you again replacement of the bone by this myeloma tissue. So they have punched out lesions in the vertebrae. It's very painful. They start to have the vertebrae sit on top of each other, which is painful. So you can see the lesions in the spine. Okay. So that's multiple myeloma. So we usually associate that with IgGs, IgAs, IgDs, IgEs. There are some IgMs that would be multiple myeloma, but most IgMs are classified under Waldenstrom's macroglobulinemia. So since IgM is such a large immunoglobulin, they called it macroglobulinemia. So 20% of all the paraproteins are really IgMs. And 50% of those are Waldenstrom's. So now it's a neoplasm again, but it is a neoplasm that could be the lymphocyte, the B lymphocyte, or the plasma cell, somewhere in there. And so these look a little bit different than the plasma cells we saw in multiple myeloma. They look more like the lymphoid cell. And again, the peak incidence of this disease is 60s and 70s. They have hepatosplenomegaly, they have enlarged lymph nodes, they have such viscous blood that the very small capillaries start to become engorged, and that's why they'll have retinal abnormalities in the eye. They do not have bone pain, so that's different than multiple myeloma. They also don't have as much renal disease, so these that are produced must be so big that they don't filter through the kidney. They don't have amyloidosis like multiple myelomas do. But instead, they have what's called hyperviscosity syndrome. So these huge immunoglobulins are making the blood so viscous that it has a problem with circulation. So they get these bulges in the small capillaries, and it looks like a sausage when it gets all blown up. They have more central nervous involvement. So they have the dizziness, the vertigo, the coma. And they can go into congestive heart failure because it's such viscous material that they're pumping around in their circulation. They also have problems bleeding because their platelets, their coagulation factors, all get coated with this abnormal IgM. They have the worst problems with the cryoglobulins. So these are so large that they just precipitate out when it gets cold. So they precipitate out in their fingertips, their ears, their nose. But it's manifest as what we call Raynaud's syndrome. And so they have these scars and replacement of tissue where these proteins start to precipitate out in the cold. So this is a neoplasm again, but it arises from anywhere from plasma cells to the lymphoid cell populations. And the malignant clone is usually the IgM, so it's the mu heavy chain. Okay, so their main problem is hyperviscosity. So there is a test that we do called the SIA water test, and it's SIA. And it's an old test, but what they noticed was that these people had so viscous of blood that the CO water test indicated that they had IgMs. But now the way we do it is just to do immunoelectrophoresis, and it migrates between the beta-gamma area. So it's a little bit to the fast side of the gamma area. So again, what they might have is just anemia, but you're going to see Rouleau. So anything that Rouleau causes, they get the increased sed rate. Their platelets are usually normal. They can be a little bit decreased, but they still have bleeding problems because they're coated with this really heavy IgM. So if you were to look on the peripheral blood, the only thing you'll probably see is Rouleau. Once you see Rouleau, you need to follow up and make sure that they follow up to test. Now, if you look at that lymphocyte, it's almost between a lymphocyte and a plasma cell, isn't it? And this is the malignant cell that you'll see. So it's more between the lymphoid and the plasma cell.
So what do we call that?
Plasmacytoid lymph. So when they do a bone marrow on these people to confirm, they may get a dry tap. What's the other disease where you got a dry tap? What? Hairy cell and what else? MMMMM? Okay. Okay, so there are a few things you get dry taps. And now you see large number of cells, these lymphoid cells, that are somewhere between plasma and lymphocyte. And again, you can find inclusions in those cells. So here is an example of a walnut stroma, bone marrow. Okay, so they're somewhere between, but can you see the Russell bodies in there? This is almost like a Mott cell, right? Okay. So what do? We do electrophoresis. They're going to have bench tones in only about one-fourth of the cases, but the thing that you have to identify is the IgM that's increased. So because of that, the total protein is going to be increased, and that's another one of the signs that we look for right up front on a metabolic panel that's done on patients. So here's what you do. Okay, it's the same kind of thing. So now we do the protein electrophoresis. You get the spike, but you identify it as IgM. Do the bone marrow, you're going to see lymphocytes or plasmacytoid lymphs or plasma cells, but they're a little bit different, and you've confirmed that with serum electrophoresis. Okay, so what do they do for these people? They try to remove some of the plasma concentrations of the IgM, so they do plasmapheresis, which means they put the patient on a, like when you go donate blood, and you want to donate fractions of it, they take off the plasma and give them back the red cells. And then they give them normal plasma. So they try to make it less viscous because they're having a hard time pumping this plasma through their system. And then sometimes they'll use chemotherapy. Okay. So we call those light chain diseases or M spikes.
With these diseases, you have like such viscous blood. Would it ever cause heart problems?
Yeah, it causes congestive heart disease. Yeah. But now there are also what we call heavy chain diseases. So you could have a problem with the heavy chain as well. It's the IgM, but it's a light chain disease as well because they have the bent stones protein. But there are also heavy chain diseases. So besides IgMs and IgGs. Okay? So you could have all sorts of problems. So there are other things that you could have. So don't just think it's just multiple myeloma and Waldenstrom's. There are heavy chain diseases as well. So these are all gammopathies because they're all in the immunoglobulins. So in heavy chain diseases, you get excessive production of heavy chains instead of the light chains being the excessive. So, again, what happens in these people is they can't make their own immunoglobulins, so they're really prone to infections. And we're just going to name them, not that we're going to do anything with them, but you could have an alpha heavy chain disease, and they call that a Mediterranean lymphoma, and they do have, again, a heavy chain disease called Franklin's. But just realize it doesn't have to be a myeloma. It could be something else. Not very common. Okay, one that you've already talked about several times, but some of you still kept missing on the exam, is you're pretty good at looking at an LE cell and saying it's an LE cell, but what does it mean? It can only mean one thing, and that's this disease, so get it right, systemic lupus erythematosus. So it would be nice if you'd write SLE for me. Lupus is okay, but, I mean, the technical name is SLE. So if you have to tell somebody, you know, they know what you're saying as well. Okay, these people then usually present with some sort of a fever. They have muscle aches. They have joint aches. They may have some sort of skin lesions. They may have psychological or neurological changes. They may have pericarditis or anorexia, nausea, vomiting, abdominal pain. They might have hepatomegaly. I mean, it's just nondescript, okay? There's not one thing. Some of them, and this is the classical sign, have this mask that's called a lupus mask. And it's a typical butterfly rash that's seen over the bridge of the nose and under the cheeks. Now, not many of them have this typically, but this is the way it was first described. And lupus means angry wolf. Now, why? You know when a wolf has the mask? Okay? So that's why it got named that. Have any of you seen Eight Below? It's a Walt Disney movie.
It's a good one.
It's quite good. It's about wolf dogs. I mean, dogs that pull sleigh. But it's so sad. Okay, so in lupus, what happens? These people have an autoimmune disease, so they start to make antibody against their own nuclei. Okay, so the antibody we call an LE factor, right? Really is not a factor, it's an antibody against DNA, and it's against double-stranded DNA to be particular. And so what happens is they get these circulating immune complexes. The complexes are so big that it deposits in organs. And, of course, the first place it deposits is the kidney because you're screening blood and filtering blood through the kidneys. And so it can cause damage to any organ, but that's one of the common places. So their white cells are decreased, but not severely decreased. Their platelets might be decreased. They may have anemia, and it could be because of their chronic disease, so they'd have anemia of chronic disease. Or it could be that they have an antibody against an antigen on their red cells. So once you make an antibody, it seems like you can make antibodies to anything. So it's not uncommon for them to have antibodies against an antigen on a red cell. And you know red cells don't have nucleuses, but they still have hemolytic anemia because they can make all sorts of antibodies. So remember, you've gone through this before, but in order for it to be an LE cell, you have to have the LE antibody, the lupus factor. You have to have double-stranded DNA that can attach to the antibody, so that would be the antigen. And then you have to have some way to demonstrate that it's happened. And so what we do is we introduce our patient's serum to some nice nuclei, and we can make the nuclei out of their own blood by beating it with a bead or squishing it through a sieve or something. But we offer them this DNA, they form the complex, and then along comes a nice little neutrophil and said, that looks real delicious to me, so I'll swallow it. And so what you're seeing as an LE cell is a neutrophil that's opened up so wide that it's engulfed that complex. So if we see... Remember, the hematoxylin body is the homogenized nucleus. If we see a hematoxylin body, remember, we have to see it engulfed by a neutrophil in order to call it an LE cell. If you see a rosette where they're all lined up thinking, I'm going to swallow that, and they saw that big thing, there's no way they can wrap their little cells around that. But the rosette tells you to look further. So you don't want to just ignore it. You'd say, whoa, I better look real fast. And don't get it mixed up with a monocyte that's just engulfed some garbage. Okay, it has to be a neutrophil. So the TART cell is a monocyte that's engulfed garbage, which is not LE. Now, when you say LE is positive, you're putting a condition on that patient they don't want to have. So you want to make sure that you're not calling them. And we don't do them anymore alone. But this test is the most sensitive test. This is an excellent test. We just don't bother with it anymore because it takes so much tech time. Okay? So what we do now is to do DNA antibodies.
So how do they, know what type of nucleus to eat?
What type of what?
Nucleus.
To eat?
Yeah. Well, or to use in their prep.
Okay, you're just using patient's blood. Okay? It contains the LE factor if they have the disease, which is the antibody. It contains cells, because blood cells are there, right? So you traumatize the cells to expose nuclei. The LE factor then homogenizes the nuclei, and then you let the neutrophils go do their thing. Okay? So this is an LE prep. Okay, there's a TART cell and a LE cell right next to each other. So can you tell that this is a monocyte that just engulfed a nucleus? Oh, you can too. Okay, can you see this is a neutrophil with granules that has engulfed a nucleus? Okay, that's the most important part.
I can see that.
So when you see the findings, bing, you know what this is, right? Okay, now, if you get an LE prep, can you evaluate platelets or red cells on that prep?
No.
Good. Don't try, okay? Because you've made a buffy coat. So all the rest is out. So to get 6 points, all you have to say is LE cell. And then for 4 points, you say SLE. And you got 10 points. And when you see it, there will be no screaming that you've seen it, okay? You say, ah! I don't want you to react. Okay. We do coagulation tests on these people because, didn't I say they can make any kinds of antibodies? They're so busy making antibodies, that's what isn't good. They even make antibodies against their own coagulation factors. And so these coagulation factors then get tied up, and then when we do our testing in the lab, we might see prolonged coagulation, which next week you're going to just be excited to learn about.
So these guys also get blue wells?
No. Their proteins are not up. Okay. And can you judge Rulo on a buffy coat?
No.
No. Or a LE cell prep? No. Okay, don't. Okay, so their main problem that gives them this disease is antibody against double-stranded DNA, even though they can make other types of antibodies. So you have to prove now that they have an anti-nuclear antibody. That is the LE factor. Okay? So this is the test that we now do, is we do anti-nuclear antibodies against double-stranded DNA. And you have to have a fluorescent scope in order to read it. So we don't do them here in lab because we don't have a fluorescent scope and we'd have to borrow somebody's. We talk about the LE prep because it's hematology and it is a much more specific test that if you see an LE cell, then that person has SLE. If you see double-stranded antibodies, DNA antibodies, they could have some other condition. Okay, so it is a great test. There's no getting around that, and it helps explain what's happening in the patient. That's why we do them. But it costs too much for you to do them in a lab. So here's what we do. We do a peripheral smear. We're not going to see much. They have symptoms, and so the doc's going to order some other things. They probably will not order an LE prep. But if they did, it would be positive. But they will have double-stranded DNA antibodies. So their anti-nuclear antibody test is positive, and they will have a certain pattern they will look for. Okay? For LE. All right, so what do they do for these people? Well, they try to keep them down. They do not want them to become pregnant. These usually women, because it's autoimmune. They don't like them to become pregnant because it exacerbates their disease. But they try to keep them out of the sunlight. They give them salicylates for their aches. Sometimes they'll give them anti-malarials to control the skin rashes that they might have. And the main thing they do is give them glucocorticoids, which is cortisone, to suppress their ability to make antibodies. They want to keep that level down. Yeah?
With that treatment, does that also improve their ability to fight off regular infection?
Yeah. That's... Yeah, you don't want to take glucocorticoids if you don't have to. It causes lots of problems. Okay. We got a few minutes to talk about instrumentation in the lab. Okay, we don't have any. That's easy. The reason we don't have any is because you have to run these every day. And when it sits for all but 6 weeks out of the year, it doesn't work. These are expensive, so we rely on the hospitals to provide instrumentation for you. So I'm just going to tell you about the basics of how they work. So when we look at the blood count parameters, the instruments that they have in the hospitals, and you have to realize that hospitals belong to corporations, and certain companies give corporations really good pricing on certain things. And so maybe Mountain Star, they all buy this brand. IHC all buys this brand because they all use the same kind of instruments. So you're going to see different brands depending on where you work, which hospitals you're training. But basically, these are the blood count parameters that an automated instrument would do. So it'll do a white cell, a red cell, a hemoglobin, hematocrit, figure your indices, and spit that out right for you. It'll also do absolute numbers, so it will do a diff for you and figure absolute numbers. It'll do an RDW, mean platelet volume, and a PDW is a platelet distribution width. So it'll tell you the sizes of platelets and figure the percentage. Now, the caution I tell you is that your brain is better than any of these instruments. If it doesn't make sense when it spits it out, you think about it and you say, that can't be. I don't care if you're a $500,000 instrument, you're not right. Okay? Because they're not always right. It's who programmed them, who calculated them, if the right reagent got in there, a whole bunch of things. So your brain has to tell you whether or not you send out that slip. And you don't say, when they come back and say, how can you get this? You don't say, well, that's what the instrument said. The instrument has no brain. So there are different counting principles that these have, and they're really divided maybe into two different areas. First one's called an electric impedance. So blood cells have no electrical conductivity. But the suspension that you put them in is saline. And saline can conduct electricity. So what you do is you suspend them in saline, you pass them through an orifice, and as they go through there, and hopefully it's such a small orifice that they line up and you count one by one, it will, as it passes, it will see a decrease in the impedance or the resistance. It will go up because it's non-conductive. So the number of pulses that it produces is proportional to the number that went through the place, the orifice. And the amplitude, or how high it goes, it depends on the cell's volume. So we can get an idea of the size of the cell. So this is sort of the principle, especially in a Coulter counter. Coulter is one of the oldest of the instruments. There's a Coulter Stack S and a Coulter I don't know what else. So there are all these Coulter counters, but this is the basic principle. You have an internal electrode, and you have an external electrode, and what you're measuring is the conductivity between. And so as this blood cell goes through this really small opening, it's drawn through with a vacuum. So it pulls the solution through. And as it goes by, then it counts the cells and tells you how large they are. So if you looked at an oscilloscope, it would show you the cells coming through there. And so the amplitude, or how high it goes, is the size of the cell. And then what it does, it just actually prints out the histogram for you.
What about platelets? Platelets also?
Mm-hmm. And you can set the orifice for different counts, too. But, yeah. Okay, the other principle is called an optical detection principle. And in this one, we use a laser light. And so what they're measuring in the laser light is the amount of scatter. In other words, how much does it scatter the laser light and how much gets to the detector. And it depends on how big the cell is and how many granules are there. So if we look just at the white cells, so how do you can you count just white cells? It's just the same as you did in your pipette. How did you get rid of all the red cells? You lysed them, right? So we don't have any in this instance. We don't have any red cells. But it divides them up into lymphocytes, the mononucleated cells, and the granulocytes. So we add this lytic agent to it, and it will act on the membrane of the cell and the cytoplasm, and it will cause a shrinkage of all the different cell types. And then it will pass them through the laser light, and it will look at the light scatter, how much is scattered because of that cell. So here are some white cells. So most of the time when we think of white cells, we think they have this cytoplasm and they have this much cytoplasm. When we add the lytic agent, it disrupts the membrane and causes the cytoplasm to flow away. So what we're looking at is just the nucleus or the scatter from the granules. So these are the types of cells that we see then. So here comes our laser light in here. So this, if it's aimed this way, this is the forward scatter when it hits that cell. And then the right scatter is up here. Okay? And so because of this, we can see then different scatters, and there's a detector that will measure the scatter.
Our lysing agent didn't lyse the nucleated.
No, this is different than...
So does theirs lyse the nucleated reds?
No, it won't.
So it can also detect the difference between...
But the scatter would be different. And I don't know where it throws them. I can show you a picture. Jan could tell you this better than I. But what they do is they combine the scatter ground that includes the forward scatter and the right scatter. And so they, because of this, will graph it for you and throw it into different sections on what's printed out. So we're going to look at that. So if we looked at just a white cell histogram and count, okay, there's the lymphocytes, the mononuclear cells, and the granulocytes. And what it does is it calculates that underneath the curves and tells you how many are there. So this tells you that you had a total white count of 9.8, and it calculated the percentage of lymphs was 32, and monos 20, and granulocytes 48. Then it took the percent times the total count and gives you the absolute count. So it tries to help you from making any mathematical mistakes. So it depends on what kind of instrument you have, what kind of histograms you have. This shows you another type of scatter where this histogram puts the monocytes here, the lymphs below, the neutrophils there, throws some eosinophils out because of the size of the granules. So you have to get used to reading the scatter as well to make sure what you're looking at. Okay, so... how would we separate red cells from white cells then? Can't lyse them. So if we wanted to count the red cells, what are we going to do? Use a smaller hole, right? Because white cells are bigger than red cells. So if you throw them through that little hole, then you should only get red cells if you put it down far enough. So then what we do is we produce a red cell histogram, and it calculates the RDW. Remember what that stands for?
Red
red cell distribution width, which is a measurement of anisocytosis. Okay, so it prints it out for you. So we'll start there tomorrow and talk about, and not tomorrow, Thursday. So tomorrow we meet in lab at 12. Okay, and we're going to do some case studies. Okay, see you up there, and then we'll finish this on Thursday.